How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
With Sanderson, of when he's writing a series, I have that feel of, oh, I'm in good hands here.
The idea the masks we wear become who we are.
Do you think Sanderson's preaching here?
Is the conclusion to a series, we actually are reviewing a full conclusion to the series. We're not going a couple books in and dropping it. It's great. We're completing things.
Okay, passive aggressive. Okay.
A little bit.
Welcome back to another Tudor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
We are reviewing The Hero of Ages, Mistborn, Book 3. This will be spoilers for Book 1 and Book 2. We will keep spoiler-free for Book 3 for just 5-10 minutes. And we'll recap for you, give you general thoughts, our rating, and then spoil the hell out of this book.
As you can tell by thumbnail and title and everything, book good. Good book. Most people agree.
You know,
we're not really bucking the horse here. We're bucking the bull.
You saw my face that I was going to say something to you, and I love that. I do that all the time where I see your reaction to things I say and I immediately alter course and go, wait a second, let me clarify whatever the crap I just uttered. You know, you said it yourself. I'll leave it at that.
Bucking Broncos. It's all the same. Whatever. Anyway, it's good. It's the conclusion to a series. We actually are reviewing a full conclusion of the series. We're not going a couple books in and dropping it. It's great. We're completing things.
Passive aggressive. Okay.
A little bit.
If I see one Howling Dark comment, I'm gonna be pissed. So you're being a little bit too mundane right now for me.
Am I?
You are, because I'd like to just kind of sit. We'll recap book two, but just for Sanderson's sake, because book five, we're recording this now, but by the time this is released, book five will be coming right around the corner.
Yeah.
And this is of Stormlight. We're not spoiling Stormlight, just giving some context here that we are about to see another finale of sorts in the Stormlight series. So how can we see how well Sanderson's going to do in Stormlight finale other than looking to his other books like Mistborn, Era 1? And this man, this king, Sanderson, you know when you go into a flight and you sit down, you're all cozy and listen to the pilot, and they're like, you know, it's going to be 70 degrees outside. We've got nice warm weather going out there. I just want you to sit back, relax, enjoy the ride.
Where are you going with this, bud?
Where I'm going with this is, as soon as you hear that nice soothing voice, just sit back, relax. We're going to be going at about an altitude of 30,000 feet. Sanderson,
that pilot that you know has salt and pepper hair, you know,
chest hair, unlike me. That's a man's man.
A massive amount of arm hair. That's necessary for being a pilot.
It's that whatever in my head with Sanderson of when he's writing a series, I have that feel of, oh, I'm in good hands here.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want your pilot going, guys, I'm having a bad day. Guys, like you just hear scratchy, like itching skin. Go, I'm on a little. No, just that calm. I feel comfortable. And Sanderson has earned every right to. Not just is he putting out books at a rate nobody else is. Stephen King, he will surpass Stephen King in Sanderson's lifetime here. Not only is he doing that, but his storytelling, his ability to conclude this trilogy for me was so shocking. And we're keeping this spoiler free for now, but so shocking because you and I both read Stormlight before we read Mistborn.
Yeah.
Not the order everybody does. So that we have that unique perspective. I was going into Mistborn thinking, I read Stormlight. I read his magnum opus. That's his best thing. So I kind of had lowered expectations of going, it's not going to be as good as Stormlight. Mind you, I still like Stormlight more. I definitely do. But this finale shocked me with how much it came together and going, wow, okay, I see why he took the wheel on Wheel of Time as well. I see. I know that when Harriet, and you know some of that story, right? With Harriet and how she read the first, what was it, 47 pages of Mistborn Book One and said, that's our guy.
Basically, she read a combination of Sanderson's eulogy for Robert Jordan and also first couple couple chapters of Mistborn and was like, yeah, that's the guy. Mm-hmm. He can finish it.
Yes.
And Brandon Sanderson really is a plotter. He knows where things are going. He plans out how a book will go, which one leads to how he's able to actually complete series in good, timely fashion because he plans it out. Mm-hmm. He's not sitting there with like, oh, I don't know how to conclude this book. He's known for a while. And very clearly from book three of this, from book one, he knew how it was going to end. He set up plenty of clues that me on a reread, I noticed them. And it's really interesting to see it. I was like, oh, man, really obvious. But on the first read through, many of them aren't really obvious. I thought it's nice and surprising, but also justified.
It shocked me that he answered questions I wasn't asking.
Yes.
That'll come up right away when we talk spoiler stuff. But there was one I'm just going, what? I didn't think that was a thing. And then it was a thing.
Yeah.
And so impressive.
There's also, if people paid attention in our book one video, I spoiled a big thing that I think you missed out.
I think we muted it, though.
I also think you forgot.
Good.
It seems like you forgot that I spoiled this. And it was a big spoiler.
No, I know. I think I know it now that I finished book three. It's one of those things that I registered but didn't connect it until I read it in the book and went, oh, yeah, didn't you mention that?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that, too. Mm-hmm. So, Rich, just to give a quick recap of... So, I we'll give you a rating in a second, but recap from book two going into book three.
Got it. So,
let them know where it ended, yeah.
Book two, we have Vin and Ellen have taken down the Lord Ruler... And now they have
to... That was book one they did,
That was
yes.
the book one. Yeah. And going into book two of, now we actually have to run the Empire. And all the things that come involved. Now all these different factions are vying for the throne. The key villain among them, Ellen's father. Strath Venture. Vindictive, evil man you love to hate. And then we have a couple different plot lines. Vin struggling with herself and what her mission will be. And her love with Ellen. Does she trust him enough? Does she trust herself? Is she deserving? All these things come to a head of Vin finds her purpose of being the hero of ages, to take the Well of Ascension and to let the power go as a real hero must, not use the power selfishly like the Lord Ruler does. And in that, she releases the greatest evil the world has ever known. The villain wins. Empire strikes back. The Lord Ruler was actually not the worst thing ever. He pretty bad, but he was holding something even worse at bay.
Let's just say Vin was not vindicated.
You were waiting on that one, huh?
When you first uttered Vin's name, I'm like, oh, I've got a one-liner that I so gotta say.
Yeah.
And so just block out what you say and say the thing in my head, you know?
I like it. Good. Vin was not vindicated in this book.
So we'll see what happens. But yes, ends there. We also had the stuff with Zane, and there was you didn't mention that because that was your least favorite part, of course.
It was my least favorite part, except for the ending line of some kind of entity whispered to Zane of, what's funny, Zane, is you were never mad. You were never truly mad this entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Zane dies.
Which has implications for where that leads to book three.
Yep.
We have Sazed and him losing faith, Tyndall dying last book. We had the murder mystery reveal with the Chandra, and so Orsor was killed by Tensoon.
We got some world building stuff of what the hell are Chandra, how are they work, what's the deal with emotional allomancy, being able to control Chandra. All this stuff.
A lot was set up there, and that's why I was so excited going into book three, because I felt like didn't get all the payoff that I wanted last book, but so much setup, still some good stuff in there, until ultimately we get to now this book, Hero of Ages. To give a quick of what do others out there think, this is the highest rated of the trilogy on Goodreads. I think right now 4.53 or 5.4 at the moment. And did a kind of spontaneous book club, by the way, join our Patreon link down below in the description if you want to join us for a monthly book club. We also do spontaneous ones, like whatever we're reviewing on the channel. And so the general consensus as well was Sanderson stuck the landing, and a couple people saying that this was actually the best ending Sanderson's ever done in a book. considering all of the Cosmere, a lot of people are saying the best finale.
That's a pretty fair point. I wouldn't fault them on that. I would say Wheel of Time ending is more of a feat. I love his ending to Wheel of Time.
Mm.
To me, he was juggling something like 25 different balls, and he dropped maybe two. Two out of 25 is not that bad. It's really awesome.
I will say Scott from Scott, hey Scott, Scott from Patreon was saying the one caveat is yes, Wheel of Time was better. But if we're just saying Sanderson, not Robert His Jordan stuff. As
yeah,
well.
Yeah, because a lot of how much credit do you give Sanderson? How much do you give Robert Jordan who planned this whole thing
A lot
out?
To Sanderson, but it's still Robert Jordan's.
Yeah. Like Brandon Sanderson was following a lot of notes. This was set up not by him. It had this actual ending. But
it's still so such a cool sort of, he was a massive fan of Wheel of Time, put out that eulogy and the honor to be able to finish the series you love that much.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
That's got to be one of the coolest things. Just
ever.
Conceptually as an author of going from one of your early literary heroes and things that got you so into writing and one of your biggest passions. And then you go into your career and then you actually get to continue on with it. That's pretty awesome.
It is.
But we're getting to the point. We've heard what we generally know what the rabble have to say.
One more
this
rabbler,
book.
Because one I just want to give a shout out to, you know, Dan. You just Dan, we went to diner with him. Like he no longer talks to us. It's been a while.
It's been a minute.
But shout out to Dan because he's been a patron now for 1 year, 9 months. That's
damn Dan.
But also because he showed up to the book club.
And he's been a patron for.
Almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years. And what did he get out of? A couple book clubs, and we bought him breakfast once.
Breakfast at midnight.
Breakfast at midnight at a diner.
But he showed up to the book club, and I thought it was cool because I had, there we go. But so it was cool because we haven't talked to him in a long time. It's nice to see Dan. We miss you, Dan. Okay. So now, done with the rabble, you wanted to get into the, what were you saying there?
We've heard what the rabble have to think.
Yes.
What do you give the Hero of Ages?
The Hero of Ages is an objective Austin Ramble rating of a 4.75 out of 5 stars. Absolutely incredible.
Fantastic.
Absolutely incredible book.
I gave it a 4.5 stars. I think it's spectacular.
Nice. Okay. So we're close.
We're close.
It explains the just ounce of enthusiasm more ahead at the beginning here. So ounce.
And how much of this is my reread of my tempered emotions because it's a reread of it. I still think, even knowing all the twists ahead of time, I enjoyed seeing how it was teased up. But I do have a small complaint on it. I'm going like, that's actually the one complaint I have. One of the big...
Spoiler-free still.
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't.
Keep it spoiler free.
It is important for spoiler.
We'll give a warning soon.
There's an important thing, spoiler wise, like one of the big spoilers, one of the big reveals, that if you are listening to the audiobook, I think spoils it.
Yeah, I see.
Just
what you mean.
Inherently, where I on my first read through, I physically read it, and I was surprised at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
In the reread, I was like, "Oh, this is way too obvious because of how the voices are done." So, that's my recommendation. Maybe it won't matter to you, but if you care at all about those kind of spoilers, maybe try and do the physical book.
I'd agree with that. Try physical for this just because that would...
It's
a big
one.
Can't give too much more other than that, but people who have read the book will understand, I think. Have listened to the book. So why did you... I guess the spoiler-free keeping it there, why did you give it that? What was the best category? What was the worst? What got you with this?
So... I would say the world building is the highest, followed behind that by plot.
I'm agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
Characters are not far behind. It's pretty up there. I think the characters take a huge step up from book two. Huge step up.
Definitely step up from book two. I 100% in my orders will have world than plot. And worst for me, and it's still good, but prose is the thing that the book doesn't do better than the rest, I'd say.
Yeah.
And that's pretty consistent with the prior two books as well. Mm-hmm. Well, without further ado, let's take you on this flight of our own. Get you all nice and cozied up. We'll be those pilots for you. And then we'll talk to spoilers. Spoiler warning?
Yep.
Okay. Spoiler warning.
You've been warned.
We will, if you're listening on and you don't care about spoilers anyways, we'll do our best to make some context as we talk about this. So, Rich.
Yep.
Emotional impact. What'd you give it out of 5 stars?
I I gave Emotional Impact a 4.
A great. Okay.
Four out of 5 stars. I did think it was great. How much of that is a reread and not the first read through where I'm not the surprise, the emotion maybe is not as clearly there. I'm not sure.
Maybe that's why I gave it a little higher, because I gave the 4.5 stars and not as high as my overall score, but spectacular. And maybe that, primary emotion, what's the book going for? Because you kind of hinted at there, the surprise and reveals, that shock value. Do you think the primary emotion here, is it shock? Is it, whoa? Is it?
I think it's all about that Sander Lynch type of deal of the stress, the anxiety, and the final release of it. And along with that is the shock of different reveals and mysteries. So a lot of this is, the ending is just bombastic. A lot of important things happen.
Yeah. That tracks for what I'm thinking, because a lot of people that read the book will say the first 80%, they can't really remember, but the last 20% then just page after page of reveals. And part of why a scene for me, so this is the thing I was referring to in the spoiler-free section, that is what made this enjoyable and just made it a page-turner, was the reveal about her earrings.
Yes.
So,
of which, that's the thing I spoiled.
Yes. Yeah, that's the thing you spoiled. And when I read that, I'm like, you bastard. That's the thing you spoiled it back in the book one review. So if anybody was wondering what it was that. But
whoopsie.
But it still was incredible to read. And when you said that to me, like, in one ear, out the other. Like, not pun not intended, just in one ear, out the other, because I tried not to think. I don't know how I was able to forget, but I forgot about it. I read it and I went, you know when you connect the dot as you read the thing?
Yeah.
It happened like that. So
good. I'm glad I didn't ruin it.
It still shocked me.
Good.
So that why that scene encapsulates why the book does it for me is that's not a mystery I was asking. I was asking about the mists. I was asking about, okay, what's this whole God thing? Who came out of the Well of Ascension? Why? What's this figure? Who's talking to Zane? How's this all connect? Who are the Chandra and all? We'll get into all the world stuff. I was asking all those questions. And then I'm going, oh, so the things that I thought in book one were kind of corny. If I loved book one, I thought it was really great. But even the things of her being able to push through the mist and to kill the Lord Ruler, and super cool. Vera was mentioning this. You go back to book one and you read the sentence or two before she draws from the mist. It's like, it says her earring falls out, or says she takes off her earring. One of those two things happens where earrings out, then she's able to then take from the mist because she no longer has ruins.
Or even the fact that she was able to pierce the copper clouds, of which it just seems, hey, she's a powerful allomancer like the Lord. We just think, oh, she's stronger.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
It's actually because her earring is a, not brass, but what it...
One of those HEMA...
it's a Hermeler...
I'm going to get this right. So you keep going. I'm going to find out the exact pronunciation.
Hemallergic?
I think hemallergy.
Hemallergy. Hemallergic spike
from
her dead sister, which gave her slight more abilities to pierce copper, which makes her stronger in that one aspect.
Yeah.
So that's why she was able, but she's only able to do that with the earring.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, which explains a lot of the problems where I kind of forgot. I forgot that part of the mystery when we were talking in book one. I forgot that was why she
maybe
could
that's
pierce
why
the
it surprised me. Yeah, yeah. So that for me. So the reveal part, since none of this was shocking or surprising to you, what did you get out of it on a reread?
Sure. I would say the best part emotionally for me was Sazen. His journey. I was most emotionally invested in his journey, specifically some of the discussions around him finding faith. And what did it mean to him? And then finally the reveal of him becoming God and realizing that all the work he's done in his life actually did have a purpose. And all the things that he thought were pointless and these religions that he didn't think, none of these are true. All of them have flaws. And he realizes, well, all of them do have flaws, but all of them have a semblance of truth and value to them. And he was able to take the pieces and I thought that was beautiful, of imagining all the mistakes that you make in your life and thinking that the course of your life was worthless, and then finding actually all those things along the way actually will help me today for this problem. And it feels like you're it was predestined. It feels like a divine moment when you realize, oh, I wouldn't be able to handle this current situation without all of these seemingly random things in my past. I loved it. So I was invested in his journey emotionally. The other character than that, really liked Spook. Spook's character journey was really enjoyable. So there's a couple scenes there that got me moved. Mm-hmm. More specifically, of course, the climax with Spook confronting the fire and basically overcoming his hero, Kelsier, speaking in his ear, his hero, finally giving him all the power and recognition that he wants and being able to deny that.
And not risk actually Kelsier, but yeah.
Exactly.
Right. But he thinks it's Kelsier.
He thinks he's...
That's my hero, right.
He's able to resist his hero and turn him down and actually help the people. His flaw of always flaring tin, where now he has deadened senses, and he uses that to be able to confront the fire. And it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So those are some of the emotional moments that really pulled me in.
Yeah.
There's others, of course, but...
Yeah, Say's is definitely a standout for me too, where he's always been my favorite character since book one, and just for him to get such a sweet ending. This had a bittersweet ending to the book, and him having everything actually, he had a meaning and purpose crisis. We'll talk in message and thought-provokingness, there'll be a lot to talk about there, but just the catharsis I felt for Say's it, and that it all came together was, oh, Sanderson had this planned all along. Sazed's the actual main character. Let's go. He's the goat. It just felt...
Also, when it comes down to world building or plot, somewhere around there, I want to discuss with you, don't let me forget, there's a couple lines that Sazed leaves to Spook in his letter that I wanted to talk to you about efficacy. Okay. Like, when...
Okay. In world or in what
was Sazed telling the truth? Or was he giving a kind lie to Spook?
Okay.
And I don't know what's true.
Okay.
And I'm interested to what are the ramifications of what he said.
I'll note that in my notes when we get to world to bring that up.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to move on to thought-provokingness?
Yes.
What did you give that out of 5 stars?
I gave this one a 4.25. I think this is definitely the highest out of the... Mistborn books.
100. It's actually a big jump up for me. But the other ones were good, had some thoughts to it. This 4.5 for me, spectacular. This message, I had two big themes I got from it. Mm-hmm. And to break those down, see if you agree as well. Faith / trust is one of them, and the other is balance.
Yep. Nature of faith and harmony.
Yep. Pretty clear cut that those are what's being battled here. The balance, we can get more into it, but obviously with ruin and preservation. But then also with the characters in Vin and Elend, and then Faith says its journey. And yeah, so let's break down Faith first. That whole thing, because you started off with that earlier. Yeah.
Let's start with Faith. Let's break it down.
Let's actually solve it.
Let's solve it. Let's break it down into its tiny chunks and put it together.
Yeah, I love the themes. So go ahead. Yeah.
So I don't think this book gives too many real answers. It gives you questions and stuff to think about in a more hopeful manner. Mm-hmm. Not that. Basically, it definitely separates the idea of faith being in the realm, or faith can be solved with logic and facts. That's not the realm at stake. Like, the reason why Sazed has such a hard problem is when he investigates different faiths, he is judging like the ultimate world of truth by the flaws of human beings, and ultimately he's going to find flaws in faith if he looks purely through logic. And one of his revelations is looking at the people. Even before he becomes a deity, he looks at how these people live. What did they value? Yeah. And judging their religions by the fruits that it actually bears instead of just by the facts. Because ultimately, religion is, like, the actual text on page is by man. And man can be flawed, but there can be
truth. Literally in this world, it can be altered. The writing can be altered.
Yeah.
So.
And so... It's not just the words are important. The actual facts do matter, but that's not the only thing that matters. A lot of it is the fruit that the faith bears, and it's important to look at, like the Church of the Survivor. What does it actually do? Who are the people that it inspires? What is the end result of the religion? That's one of its true tests. So I thought that was a good insight to think about, something you should look around with yourself. I know it's a big part of it for me is looking around the world and going, you can judge ideology, thought, groups by how people act and treat you, and look at the group that you are potentially want to join. If you like an ideology or you agree with something, take a look at the people.
Start using the Rambler rating, because like, look at us. That's a hard ask, but you to use the system, right?
If you find yourself going, hey, I like how Richard and Austin think.
And talk about books.
Maybe their system has something of worth. Versus if you just don't like the way we think and you go, yeah, I think their leaps in logic are stupid. I don't like how they even process these things. Our Rambler system is probably not for you.
The rambling might, but maybe not the system. Yeah.
Or you're not right for the system. That's also a possibility. It's true.
and in Sazed's case, where this faith crisis he had, I know it's really honed in on faith and trust, but this faith crisis he had is really a meaning crisis too. So lack of purpose, where even, let's say he doesn't become a deity, because he does in this fantasy world, but just to see the fruits of his labor, everything he kind of worked for had meaning to it.
Yeah.
Was a core issue of what he was kind of struggling with. It wasn't just, I don't believe in anything. He was getting into this depressive cycle of Tyndall's death, and now he's kind of left there meandering, looking at what's the point of this all.
And a big point what value. Of Ham really drove a hard blow to him in book two, telling him that you're preaching all these different religions, and yet you really don't believe in any of them. It's easy for you to believe in everything, because that means you don't have to stand by anything. Mm-hmm. You don't have to stand for something. Believing something means you're willing to defend it. Sazed, whenever he's confronted with a fault in religion, he just pivots to another religion. Well, it could be true. And basically, he's the ultimate fence sitter. And when he's confronted with that, finally going, now Tinwell's death, and he starts going back through the different religions of what happened to Tinwell's soul. Will I ever see her again in another life? Mm-hmm. Now he's confronted with, because he never truly had faith, he finds it lacking. And so he now has to confront it.
What do you think about some of that finale then? Maybe is this a complaint of yours? Would it be that every faith did have value in the end? Because he was a fence sitter, but every faith in the end did have some value to it, where this is how he mapped out the stars from this faith. This is how he knew how to put, how to create plants from this faith, because he used every one that had an inherent knowledge to it.
Yeah. It's a combination of both the ideas of faith and the ideas of just different cultures and people. There's generally good ideas all around. You need to find them. Not everything's great. Again, this is a fantasy world. So in this one, he literally becomes God. There is a right answer. God is an actual two individuals. So
if you were to put in a faith argument here, so a lot of arguments for God, one of them is the design.
Yeah.
So the design argument, which this book does get into a bit, where preservation is giving symbols of 16. Mm-hmm. There's too many coincidences in this world for six. There's 16 elementic metals. There's 16. There's a lot of
something.
16.
16. City 16. Things.
16% of people are getting sick from the mist, and 16% of the 16 kept on coming. There's this pattern to the universe, and to separate art from artists, yes, but just to give a little insight there, Sanderson and his religious beliefs. I see a lot of probably his internal struggle when he was combating. Hey, do I have faith? He's probably. Mm-hmm. Expressing some of the things that he goes through, or any normal person would go through when believing in something and questioning yourself. And so the by design discussion that happens here in this book, yes, God exists. Multiple gods exist.
Yeah.
And so what do you think, how was that handled for you? I guess the design portion.
I think it asks enough questions for it, and especially it being a fantasy world of it, that all of the faiths were wrong in some way or the other, but because the fruits of their labor, that maybe they had some aspects wrong, but they got enough right where it's still valuable and it's something to be drawn on, that it's not necessarily solely tied to faith. It's also just cultures. He's pulling from different cultures, not necessarily different religions. So it's, I don't know, it's not a one-to-one. Like, to say that this is a one-to-one allegory of how faith works,
I was going to ask you that. Not do you, really do you see this as being because, subtle, or is it? Do you think Sanderson's preaching here, or does he do it well enough to where it's?
No, that's the thing. I don't think it's preachy because, especially in this world, it's a combination of there are different faiths that are clearly set out as wrong, but also the true religion isn't really even a religion. They're just God is a power that can be taken up by mortal beings and basically do what they want. And that's the truth of it. The signs of a deity are pretty clear of people know, oh, yeah, no, the ash came. Like, the world was literally changed up X thousand years ago. So, yeah, I don't know if it's a direct allegory for God itself and more the idea of different cultures and beliefs. Not necessarily religious beliefs, but beliefs in different value systems have value and should be at least examined and not completely discounted.
Yeah. Some will say, because Sanderson being a Mormon Latter-day Saints, mm-hmm. This is mentioned, but since Sazed ends up with a planet, or in worlds with Sanderson, people end up with planets and this kind of, people can go and extend that to go, okay, is he preaching his faith of, he thinks everybody ends up with a planet and then going through all that. But I don't know Mormonism or Latter-day Saints well enough to know if that's the beliefs or what the beliefs exactly are. I have a Wikipedia knowledge about it, so I can't really talk on it. But
I'll be honest, it's not, if that's preaching, it's not the same level as like Orson Scott Card. That's in some of his books, it is preachy. I don't think Sanderson's that way.
What I do like about it, those two things we talked about with faith, of so you can't fight logic with faith, or it's getting at that of or fighting
fight,
logic
you
with
can't
faith
fight
is
faith with logic.
Yes, yes, you can't fight faith with logic, right? And then, is this coincidence or is this providence? That kind of idea of, is this mm-hmm. from some God? How many coincidences does it take for you to go, this, there's a higher purpose to this? Little insight as well with Sanderson. So I want to caveat this too, because he says Sanderson believes in a simulation theory. However, the way he says the simulation is simulation meaning God. So he kind of, how he explains it, he in intentionally blank with Dan Wells, Sanderson was saying how rules such as there being a cap on light speed, how the speed of light is a certain number and can only go so fast. He kind of extends that and goes, well, if we were living in if God created something, there would be a limit to the universe. And he kind of sees these rules and structures in the universe and a little portion of that. He didn't get too detailed, but you could see that he was talking about how, since there's rules, structure, et cetera, in the universe, that's part of why he's religious. There's a lot more, I'm sure, but that's part of why. And a little bit of this discussion about design here, I kind of saw like, okay, I see the argument here, and he does a good job at presenting it, I think. And even beyond that, I think the even better part, so the faith conversation, that other one we mentioned with balance and harmony. What did you think about that and the big two things? So first, with ruin and preservation, that was a theme throughout the entire book with them. Did you get anything interesting, life-changing?
I guess this one less so than the ones about faith.
Yeah.
This one being just, to create, you necessarily have to preserve and destroy. That you can't, preservation alone cannot create anything new. Makes sense. To create, something has to go.
I saw a little bit of similarities here with some of the messaging as in Stormlight stuff. A lot, actually, with faith and with destroy to protect. And there's some things about having to do something tough or hard in order to protect, in order to actually get the good outcome that you want.
Yeah, a combination of that with a lot of good comes through sacrifice. So preservation is able to sort of win the day through sacrificing themselves for it. Both the earlier version of preservation and also new preservation, Vin. Vin, basically the ending conflict is preservation new. To destroy ruin, you would have to destroy themselves. Yeah. And because it's preservation fundamentally can't do that. Vin, being more recently human, has the ability to sacrifice themselves and, you know, ruin themselves for the preservation of others. And ultimately the kind of idea of harmony. And so through destroying themselves, create something new.
And then that tidbit with Ellen and Vin as well, where I can give the quote here, just kind of encapsulates it. So Ellen says at one point, "There has to be a balance, Vin. Somehow we'll find it. The balance between whom we wish to be and whom we need to be." Ellen and Vin's character arcs in a sort, which we'll get into in a second, is Vin, Ellen realizing that his old self is still a part of himself, and Vin realizing that her new self is still a part of herself. So that Ellen having to reflect, Vin having to look forward and kind of meet the old and new you, mm-hmm. as a balance and harmony. You're not just a new person. You're not just the person you used to be. You're a combination of both, which I thought was super cool for a message to go, okay, because a lot of the times we can redefine ourselves and go, this is who I am, but you can't, don't look back at who you were and think that you're completely disconnected from that. And, and don't have such an ego of yourself today or your ego self of the past, because both of those can lead to depressing situations. If you look nostalgic at who you once were and you don't look at yourself, listen, you were still once that good person. You can use that to be a better person tomorrow. And similarly, hey, if you think you're so great today, humble yourself by looking, look at the mistakes you made in the past too. I got
also
a lot of that
in the same way of when you look back at yourself and who you used to be with disdain, discomfort, cringe, whatever it is, not to fully divorce, like, oh, I used to be so cringy, like, partly, but you also still are. And you are not completely divorced from your past. I think that's, again, it's that balance thing of you don't deny your past, but also don't get stuck in it.
Yeah.
Basically, Ellen has to, he's trying to divorce himself from who he used to be, but he doesn't want to. And he realized, no, I'm still that kind of person. I still have those ideals. Mm-hmm. I just need to find a new way forward to accomplish it. Vin, in the same way of realizing, oh, this book specifically is, yeah, I am a, you know, dirty street urchin girl, but also I am the daughter of a nobleman. And there's a reason why I'm so good at navigating this. At, like, this isn't a persona. This isn't a mask I put on. It is who I am. Mm-hmm. So all these good things. There's also an idea of the idea the masks we wear become who we are. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of this book. Like, that's a lot of it in book two. But I think we see it somewhat in book three. You carry that on to Spook. Of Spook, you know, puts on the mask of, like, who he wants to be. He's, like, trying to redefine himself, and he ultimately kind of does. And how long do you need to pretend before it becomes reality? Fake it till you make it.
Sanderson tackles this all really well. Yeah. I'm even trying to, why did I give it so low? I'll stick with my 4.5. It's still amazing. But even just talking about this now is getting thought bubbles out there. So,
yeah.
Okay. Want to move on to characters?
Yeah. Sounds like a good
place. What'd you give characters out of 5?
Characters I gave a 4.5. I thought they were spectacular.
Wow.
Bunch of great characters this time. I don't think there's a single weak character in this. All of them get very gratifying, satisfying endings. The deaths and emotional moments, especially a lot of this comes at reflection. At the very, very end, Vin talks about all the people that have basically, man, the original crew is like, there's not many of us left. Mm-hmm. And going through that list of people that they've lost along the way was really impactful for me, realizing, like, oh, how much they had an impact and how important they were to the story. And I felt their deaths, especially at the end.
The crew itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think really there was a weak character here.
This was better than the first two books for me. I think I gave those 3.5s. This one stepped up. I gave 3.75. Really good characters. Let's start where we agree.
Okay.
I still think you're right. There's no one I was annoyed by. There wasn't a Zane, you know. So
yeah.
We're Sazed.
Sazed.
When I start Sazed.
Sazed.
He's
great.
The protagonist, basically.
Basically. He's Jesus.
Yeah.
He is the eventual God. I mean, Jesus is the Son of God and also God, but not, it's fine.
Your analogy worked.
We're not going to get into the trilogy now.
Oh, Mormon being book three, the trilogy? Is that what you're getting at? The Old Testament,
New
Testament?
I was going with the Son, the Father, the Holy Spirit, of how they're technically all the same, but they're also different.
Oh.
Like, Jesus is the Son of God, but also God, and don't confuse them of like, Jesus was at one time just the Son of God. No, he was always the Son of God, and also at the exact same time, God. And also, for some reason, the Holy Spirit is also somehow in there, and I don't know how it works. It's confusing.
Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
And it's not trilogy, it's the Trinity.
Yeah,
sorry.
That's why I was confused, because I thought you were talking about like the trilogy and making the whole...
That's fine. All the tri-words. The triangle.
The sickles, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, with Sazed, why Sazed's in this story, and we kind of hinted that already, his story of finding purpose, finding meaning, his initial flaw as he's walking through this world is he lost meaning, he lost his faith, and he's having an internal crisis, and he's having an internal crisis about, is all my work for naught? Was this all in vain? What do I do? And that conversation from Ham and Tyndall's death led him here. The journey he goes through, and I think the couple characters that reflect and try to change his mind, or the characters he reflects upon, are Spook and Breeze a bit. They kind of give him those conversations back, and Spook's character here of how he overcomes really
Spook
helps.
Really, it's the simple answer. Like he gives Sazed just such a faith-based answer that does resonate with him.
Yeah.
Where other people, and Sazed himself, is trying to find a factual reason to believe, and he wants answers. He wants hard, concrete evidence. And Spook's like, yeah, you're looking in the wrong place. That's not what faith is. And it gives him an answer that, you know, Sazed's heard before. Like, it's not new to him, but coming from Spook and then seeing how Spook uses his faith, he's able to judge Spook's words by how Spook acts, and seeing, look at the strength that this young man has now grown into. Look at who he's become because of his faith. Mm. There has to be something more to his words. It's not just empty words to him. Because I now see the direct impact of those words. There's something there.
The best part about, I think, of Sanderson's characters as well, is why it feels so earned. Mm-hmm. Even in the moment where Sazed then finds out, wait, his terrorist religion, there's literally people alive. So I guess some context to help with people who haven't read the book, if people are listening on. But the Chandra in this world, the first generation, they're called in the Chandra world, were created by the Lord Ruler. And this first generation are real live people. Okay, the Chandra now, they're real live beings who have the terrorist religions.
They used to be the terrorist people, and they were turned into these monsters.
So that they have the answer Sazed's seeking. So even Sazed goes out and says, oh my God, there's the source. This can't get corrupted by ruin. It can't get changed. I'll just go talk to them. Even after they kind of talk to him, his initial reaction to that is similar to all these other situations where he goes, I've kind of heard that. He's researched 500 plus religions. They all have similarities. It's nothing new. It's nothing inventive. So again, when it came back to even his own religion, Sanderson, what he does with his character arc is he presents this and you go, ah, this is the aha moment, and Sazed still sticks true to his character and his flaw and goes, well, this isn't a new...
It becomes not faith. His faith now becomes, okay, this is actual factual evidence, and the terrorist faith is talking about more true historical facts. Like, he's putting the pieces of the mystery of the world together, but that's not faith in this context. Like, it's just... It's like if Sazed was like, what is the answer of the universe? And the book's like, well, E equals MC squared. It's like, correct, but that doesn't answer my question of faith.
You just created a nuke. I didn't want that answer.
Yeah, that's
Einstein,
not the same.
What are you doing?
So, ironically, Spook's answer of just believing that everything is going to be okay despite how it is, that's faith. That, and seeing how Spook faces impossible odds and the circumstances that he's in, that's a better argument. Mm-hmm. Which, myself, I kind of agree with that. If you're trying to argue faith through logic, I don't think you're going to win. I don't think you're going to make that strong argument that way. It's more of a feeling of the personally, the beauty of the world is a much better argument for faith than anything else.
Morality actually. For you. The more metaphysical stuff could have convinced you rather than, hey, look, this is where this was at this time. Here's corroborating evidence.
There's plenty of, because that's where you're fighting faith with logic. I can also, on the flip side, fight logic with emotion. And not the simple stuff of like, oh, haha, he got emotional. It's more of, I put myself into a logical argument of, I fundamentally disagree with something that logically makes sense. And there's no other way to square that hole. And so, like, either I'm a monster, or...
Please explain this crisis. Logic is not enough. Give us an example.
You want me to give you, like, actual juicy answers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh God. I don't like the way your eyes just went up to the heavens.
I'm trying to figure out a way to, like,
you're
say
seeking
this.
God right now for an answer.
Basically, the idea of God, this is probably not the category to talk about this. But
wait for later, or what?
I'll be brief. I'm gonna pose the question and not answer it and let people think about it. Okay. That's what's gonna be great. Idea of objective morality versus subjective.
Oh yeah, we've
morality.
Talked about. Okay, yeah,
we've
yeah.
talked about this plenty of times. The idea that morality is just what we make it, and that there is no actual power behind it. There is no ultimate truth. It's just whatever we decide. Logically, yeah, that's kind of true. And that ultimately the idea of, you know, basically someone's loss of life is just whole, whether that's right or wrong is wholly dependent on who's in power. Sure. That's technically true.
Are you saying like might equals right? Like that kind of awful way that, yeah.
I guess. No, that's just how the world works. Yeah. That really is. Like whatever people decide is right will become right by the history books. It's kind of how it is. That's logically speaking. But I don't believe that. I think there is a right. There is a wrong. Despite how I may feel. And even then.
And your struggle though is.
My feelings are irrelevant to the idea that there is a right and wrong. Mm-hmm. That. Someone, a random person dies halfway across the world, I'm going to feel less of an emotional attachment to that than someone dying right in front of me. That on a grand scale, both are equal. Like, imagine both being tragedies, you know, a innocent young 10-year-old child dies right in front of me by shot in the head right in front of me. Someone halfway across the world, exact same situation. I don't feel the same way. Because my emotional attachment is dependent on where I am, who I know. But that doesn't make one case more wrong than the other. And so I know that both my logic and my emotions are flawed. And that's why I do believe in a more higher morality. That my emotions are not the ultimate determination of what is right.
And you're conflicting with that because if you believe there is an objective, but you don't believe in a God...
Now you see where I have a struggle of faith.
That's your conundrum because you go, how can I feel that there is something? But your logic side, you're logicking yourself way out of God, but you want to believe there is something that makes sense of this world and there is something that is right and is something that is wrong.
It's not even a want to believe. It's I don't believe that morality is completely subjective. I just don't believe it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, put into the test, I don't believe that to be true.
Because you feel that way.
I feel it. I can't logic my way into thinking that.
Mm. Because then you have the, I think, cosmic skeptic, his name's Alex, right? But like he'll talk about the emotivism, I think is the term for it, where we feel something's wrong. Our words are just an expression of an emotion that goes, that's wrong because I feel it is wrong. Yeah. Ew. It's like you're saying, ew to this, or, ooh, yay, I like this. And
That it's
emotions
our emotions, chemical reactions to good incentives over evolutionary. Like, why do we have an attachment to our fellow man? It's because society, like, people evolved.
You're
to be
attached
able to take care of others, not everyone.
Okay,
our community.
I thought we were going so off topic. I thought to make
we
it
have
about me.
We try to keep on topic, and we have deviated.
Well, we got
to
ramble once. Come on.
Once a video, we got to.
Well, we should do another one about morality, just so it seems like we're...
Make it more clear. I know I have posed questions, and I've not given any of my answers, mostly because I don't even know the answers. Just, these are the problems I have. These are the problems running around my old noggin.
And so Sazed was struggling with some of this, a portion of what you're talking about. And that's what that character, you kind of, not maybe not see yourself in him, but you're looking at that struggle and going, ah, this is something that's interesting.
Exactly.
And the conclusion to him, I think we talk about Sazed a ton.
Yeah.
Want to give some shine to other characters. Of course, Ellen and Vin.
Ellen and Vin, though, I will say, not, they were so much more improved. Like, Ellen was so improved in book two that this is not a huge jump. He was still really great in book three, but it was a continuation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge jump in character motivation. From the beginning of the book to the end, he didn't change too much. He was just a very good character and compelling character to see. Of like, hey, that's how I would want a ruler to be. That is the ideal leader. Great to see.
Honestly, Vin and Ellen, their character arcs or their characters this book do more for the message to me than their characters of just that balance and harmony. For I guess my, I've really good, 3.75 for me, really like it. But my biggest thing is I never got hooked on Vin or Ellen. I think they are serviceable characters. And Ellen did great book two. I think his character arc book two is great, but they're serviceable characters that.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Fill their role. They're not just completely replaceable. I can't go, okay, Vin could be replaced by Shallan or something like that. She's her own character, but there's a bit of, mystique's also the wrong word, there's just a bit of lack of depth to them where I'm going, okay, they're neat, and for them being, her being the protagonist as well, going through a similar arc, book one, book two, and then ultimately in this book three, does a good job as well, nails it home, but never got super... Mm-hmm. Never got super deep into their characters.
I enjoy her uniqueness as a character and how she reacts to a lot of things. Her reaction of just being this kind of feral street urchin is unfair. In book one, that's how it seems. But I think there's some great reactions of when Ruin comes to gloat and shows up as her dead brother, just to gloat in her face of, haha, I've won. How does she react? Incredibly cold and logical. She's a very, very smart character, always trying to outthink her opponent, but doesn't overthink. It's an interesting balance of she does actually is highly critical, always aware, analytical, but when she comes to a conclusion, she knows I have to go with my decision. I can't, once I've made a decision, I don't second guess myself because that will cause problems. Really cool character in the sense of, I really loved how she reacted to basically evil God, you know, the devil himself comes to gloat and she's just in go mode of like, okay, wait a minute. Why is he coming to gloat now? Why is he revealing to myself now? He's here to gloat. But why is he gloating now? He could have done this before. That it's only because I'm trapped here. Because when I wasn't trapped, there was a chance that he could lose. That's the only reason he's gloating now.
I like
which
that.
Means I need to get out of here because there was actually something. There was an option. I can win.
Yeah.
Loved that, of how smart she is.
I like that. However, I feel that her, Ellen, and Sazed all have that quality where I think that's Sanderson speaking, not Vin. As much. I think when she's solving that problem, going, wait a second, why is Ruin doing this in the world that Sanderson's revealing? We also get that same logic from Ellen and that same logic from Sazed. All of those problems they face, they go, wait, and as they connect the dots, as they outthink, and Ellen also strategizes, I think that's similar for all of them, is more so like Sanderson giving us some plot. And that doesn't make me feel attached to her character because they're all doing that.
I guess it's the dichotomy of her being such a violent person and just her analytical mind with how on the outside people see her as just very violent and impulsive, where she's kind of both of those things, but there's something a lot more to her, which I enjoyed as her character.
I mean, another example of her having this lot, her type of brain is when Ellen dies, she doesn't cry. She kind of goes, this was, it had to happen eventually.
I said goodbye to you.
Said goodbye
over
already.
A year ago.
Yeah.
Everything else after was just extra time.
Yeah, I guess with Vin, Ellen, that's my main thing. It's not even a major complaint. Good characters, but not even similarity, but I hear Sanderson's voice a lot with them, and seeing how they are often all logical enough to kind of fill in world bits for the reader. Mm-hmm. And so I'm getting more, okay, they are the characters that are giving us the information of the world, less than them being more so than them being these realized characters of their own, although they're good, serviceable characters. My standouts are Sazed. My other standout would be, a Spook. You like Spook this time?
I like Spook a lot. They took he took a character that for two books was kind of just there. And that's the point of the character. He's literally just the guy that's there. He's the extra.
Yeah.
Gets a few funny lines in book one. That's about it. And ultimately a sad betrayal and tragic in the book two of, oh, wow, he ran. When everyone else was willing to fight, he ran.
Mm-hmm.
And now, book three, we get just a very determined young man trying to prove himself that he is not who he was, that he can remake himself. And he's willing to sacrifice a lot to overcome what he did in the past.
Yeah, it was a good character arc. Yeah.
And definitely like Spook becoming, you know, fantasy Batman. Always fun. Always great fantasy Batman stuff, but it's more than that. It's more than him just becoming superpowered, you know, using his cool powers to I can hear he's basically becomes Daredevil, but fantasy. It's more he's given his hero and God literally comes to him and gives him everything he wants. Mm. And he's still able to resist everything he's ever wanted for what's right. That's a sign of that's a really good character. That's a moral. That's a moral, admirable character.
But what is morality anyways? Want to give us another one of those?
No, not now.
Every section.
Making a 3-hour video.
Yeah. And what? So we also had some characters like Yeoman and Quellian, the citizen. Those characters, maybe won't talk too much about them, can brush up on plot. I don't think there's anything crazy.
Yeoman's more fun. Quellian is, he was corrupted by the Lord Ruler. The same thing as Spook, but not as moral.
I have some world-building praise to give to all of that, but...
Yeah, character-wise, it's just they were manipulated. That's about it.
And
we also get Marsh. I don't think we should brush over Marsh as a character for this book. I was very compelled and felt very sad for him how he's trapped in his own mind and the amount of will that he had to overcome by the end and him knowing I could barely move a finger. So by the end, we get a lot more of his backstory of how he, again, the same thing with Spook. He gave up on the revolution. He gave up. And ultimately, he feels like a complete failure. And at the final hour, he comes through. And it feels so cathartic for him to rip Vin's earring out at the last moment to save her. I think it's a great moment for him, especially how much he has to sacrifice to be able to do.
That. Yeah.
I enjoy his character.
And what about characters? So we have Ruin Preservation, more so God entities, and Lord Ruler changed a little bit. He wasn't in this book, but you see the Lord Ruler little differently.
A lot differently. And even Sazed's going
a little.
Sazed probably goes a little too far.
He goes a bit far.
Yeah, Lord Ruler's still not grand.
Not a quality guy. No. Mainly, he was also corrupted as time went on, too. So,
yeah, Sazed does a good job of saying, Lord Rule is not perfect, but he had good intentions at the beginning. He's not a complete maniacal maniac of, I just want power.
However, the path to hell is
paved with good intentions, yes. So, interesting.
But he's not necessarily a good person. He still did a lot of bad things, but he was also the reason they were able to survive in the end by preparing humanity for the time to come.
He was not just seeking power for himself. He planned for things even if he's dead.
For those other than himself.
Yeah, which...
But probably for his own well-being too, so yeah.
All those living all those caches were...
If he dies.
If he dies. Yeah. That's a lot of work to go into, He knows, he like, hey, if I fail, I want my people to still survive.
I just don't think he thought he would fail.
Hard to believe, but yeah. He did put a lot of work into that.
He did. You know, credit where credit's due.
He did do some good stuff, other than the ash and slavery.
Plot time?
Yes.
What did you give plot out of 5 stars?
I gave plot a 4.5.
Spectacular.
Spectacular.
This was my second highest category, 4.75 out of 5 stars. We're starting to get like why this book was getting me. Absolutely spectacular. So I have some of the plots broken down here.
Yep.
And let's see if this covers them or if I'm missing something. We have one of the A plots is Phaedric City and Yeoman.
Yep.
And that includes Ellen and Vin's plot as well. So there's portions there. We have the other A plot, which is with the citizen.
Oh.
with Quellian. Quellian and whatever. Spook stuff. That the other city, right? Mm-hmm. So we have those two cities, and then we have Spook's plot there. Then we have another A plot with Sazed's internal conflict. The other A plot with Tensoon, the little escape that Tensoon does, and that comes into build to the overall plot.
Would that be more B plot?
Sorry, I'm using the incorrect. So when I'm saying A plot, I'm just saying the surface plot that happens, and then the B. So
by, understood.
When I'm saying B plot, so the B plot of this story would be ruin versus preservation, is what I'm thinking.
Gotcha.
Just because A plot's like, oh, what's the thing that's happening? Then what's the real story is the B plot, mm-hmm. And so you know we got Tensoon and that stuff, all that, and then all of that underlaid with ruin versus preservation, god battle, and obviously all of those intertwined with the final. If I'm missing one, I think that covers it.
No, you got it.
So to break those down, it looks like there's 5 things to talk about. And the first two we can kind of cover, the two cities.
Yes.
Okay.
Which do you want to tackle first?
I guess Phaedric City.
Phaedric
so
City.
So we have the yeoman who we eventually found out was corrupted by the Lord Ruler. Not corrupted by the Lord Ruler. We find he's not the one corrupted. Quellian's corrupted. Yeoman is the one that. I want to talk both at the same time, real quick. Just because Phaedric City, the concept behind this is Yeoman believes the Lord Ruler's still alive.
Well, you get the fun like book three, the city that is run by a agent of the now dead Lord Ruler. The enemy actually has a pretty well-functioning city.
He's an obligator, but
he actually has relative stability. He's treating people generally well. He is a good leader, all things considered. And then you have the citizen who is following the survivor, heroes, and ultimately he's basically burning down cities and killing a bunch of people and ultimately the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fun little twist in book three and the old idea of harmony, of like little give and take, balance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And those plots kind of, that's where Ellen and Vin are all involved and where Spook's involved, where we get this buildup of, I think why a lot of people think the first 80% kind of brushed over is a lot of it's spent with Ellen. They're building up the Kalos army, but they're also going to they're trying to preserve humanity. So I guess the plot starts off with a search and a hunt. Very first couple of chapters is the hunt for the Lord Ruler stash and cash. So they're going to the city to get the last cash, and they need to get in there to find out what's the answer to this. How do we beat this entity? How do we beat ruin? And so through that journey, through that plot structure, we see Ellen and Vin, and we see Spook in these cities, and then other characters as well are involved. For you, I guess the A plots in general, was there something about that was compelling to you, or is it all in the finale? Because which way do you go for this book? Because a lot of people say it's the best Sanderson finale, but is the plot that the whole way through?
I think the whole plot's great.
Yeah.
Specifically because there's a lot of world building that is done in this book. A lot of info is given to you in this book. A part of it I will show, so I'll get my nitpick out of the way. There's so much that needs to be conveyed in this book that all the epitaphs with Sazed the epigraphs at the beginning of chapters with Sazed talking about just the nature of how the world works is a little bit.
This is how the world works. Sorry, Bo Burnham. You got to. Okay, sorry, it just comes to me.
It's a bit on the nose of like, it couldn't come out organically. This there's just so much stuff that he basically just has to tell you. Now, it's an enjoyable way to go through it. It is hidden by the overall mystery of who exactly is writing this, because if you're reading it physically, you don't necessarily know it says it. It could be Vin. I think that's what you're led to believe. Then, haha, it's actually says it. Audiobook kind of spoils that. There's the thing I was mentioning before in the yes. beginning of the book. That's the twist that was spoiled by the audiobook. To that point, other than that, setup, it was very important for the ending of this book. So I don't think it was meander around and the only thing important is the ending. But what are your thoughts? Do you think the ending is by far the most important, or did you like the whole thing?
Yeah, ending was definitely the most important part. I guess why I'm not giving it the 5 stars floored is mm-hmm. only because it wasn't top tier the whole time. But I thought it was also great throughout the book. I think, to give an example of the Tensun plot line, where Tensun starts in prison in the Chondra lands, and we get to see the second generation and a very bare bones, it's not the point of the story, but an escape type heist, not a heist itself, but escapes. It's not a big compelling, whoa, how did he escape? How'd you do it, Tensun? But the point for his story is just he escapes. I thought it was really cool in his plot how he uses Kelsier's bones to then as he's going through, was it a random city that he went through?
In Luthadel.
It was in Luthadel. Okay, yeah. So in Luthadel, uses Kelsier bones, starts to spread these rumors. So that was a cool aside to go, oh, we're still using the survivor's bones from book one.
I think maybe it's an important aspect to talk about this book just briefly is, even though Kelsier's dead, you know, 2 books after his death, he's still a very important character. And we learn a little bit tidbits. Impressive on how much character work and how much of an impactful character he is for being a dead guy.
He had a good plan. Kelsier changed the world.
Good plan, but also a very flawed man, and interesting how people see him after his death.
Yeah.
Wonderful to explore a character post-mortem.
Yes.
Great, great job that Sanderson did with that. So I think that's more character work, but it's important to note.
Yes. And my point with the Tensun plotline or the escape is not necessarily that that's the most wow plotline ever, but the whole purpose of that and the setup for the payoff of, in the end, the ATM is there. All the why this plot floors me in some ways, in many ways, is every single reveal we get, whether I was asking the question or not, is tied together. Either it was set up since book one or from book two, and even in this own book, every single part of it. So the reason that we get Tensun's point of view and the reason that we see a bit of the Chondra this book is needs to matter when we find out where the ATM is, and that needs to come together in the end. The conclusion here just makes everything that, even if it wasn't the most compelling while reading it, the Sanderlanch as it hits only hits because this entire book gave enough nuggets and gave enough things that you're just going, oh my God, reveal, just some of the reveals. So the Renan earrings, the earrings portion,
yeah,
already talked about that, but Reen's voice and how that was set up is now kind of Ruin's voice, that reveal, Ruin can't read, and how that was interesting and how that would play it off, and with preservation and the entire mists and the reveal of how the mists were actually helping them all along. And it was preservation is the mist when this whole time we're thinking it's killing people. That shocked me. I didn't know that the mist was there to help us. And on reread, obviously you knew that was happening. Did you get a little different perspective?
It was real big hints of how much the mist is leaving them alone and going, like, it's snapping them, turning them into mistings.
Yes.
Makes sense, especially with how many times they drop of what it takes to become a misting. Of it takes beating. They go through the terrible, most terrible shock and pain of their life. And it's like, you look at what happens to them in the mists. Maybe. Maybe we'll see. And then especially early on in the book of, I think they talked about only, I think they said 15 or 16% of nobles are mistings. So it's like, I don't know. I should have picked it up earlier.
But you wouldn't know that at first, right? And that 16 being a common, as we talked about, in thought-provokingness. But for me, I guess what I'll say about Sanderson books, you can complain about Stormlight lengths and Mistborn lengths. They are long books. the reason I give so much credit, and yes, it could technically could be shortened. Yeah, I get it. I get why I give so much credit is I never feel that my time's wasted. When the chapters are drawn out, and sure, I get the point of Sazed's having his internal struggle. He spends time on that. He spends time on getting you to sometimes right in your face of even with the telling of the world and make sure the reader understands this is how this works. This is how this plot line, focusing on it, making you spend time here. But I always trust him because even the time spent in those quote unquote boring parts, I was not bored in this book, but even in those times where not the most exciting actions happening, later on only hits and only pays off because that was properly set up. So it's just that feeling of I trust any scene he's showing me, because the whole point of an author is you have infinite freedom to show you any scene that could ever happen in the book. So the more satisfied I'm going to be is every piece of this, every chapter had a point to it. I guess I would feel a lot worse if this book was so long and then I'm going like, ah, but what about all that portion there? Which is more book two of why I had some complaints, but this one just not at all.
It's also not just every scene had a point necessarily. Like it's all the scenes were very important, but I also had a lot of fun. So I enjoyed Ellen talking with Yeoman. All of his back and forth was a fun example to see how these characters think. Mm-hmm. These characters playing off each other were really enjoyable. All the smaller moments of Breeze with Spook and Sazed bouncing off each other were maybe not important plot moments, but very fun for the character. I think he does a good job of balancing a bunch
excellent of stuff. Excellent job, too, because things can feel plot armory. So when Vin gets captured by Yeoman and the back and forth, the dialogue with Ellen and Yeoman even, but with Vin and Yeoman, the reason for Yeoman not killing her initially makes perfect sense. Just the fact that he believes in the Lord Ruler and this higher power, and that why does the Lord Ruler want him to believe that Vin killed the Lord Ruler? What is his purpose in the Lord Ruler's plan? He has such fervent belief that he needs to find out information from Vin or for his God. Feels this devotion.
Why do I not kill Vin for killing the Lord Ruler? Simple. I don't think she killed the Lord Ruler.
But why does Lord Ruler
want me to think that?
Why does Lord Ruler want her to think she did kill him? Because it's just this mind games that you see and why he believes this does so much to, I know this is world credit too, but why it hit too. But the Lord Ruler lived for 1,000 years. The fact that people still use the Lord Ruler's name in vain and is ingrained in their culture, even for this plot point, is just so necessary to show, look, he was so ingrained in this culture. He's so everywhere that it's that unbelievable that he would die. There has to be a person like this in this world.
Well, the funny thing is Yeoman makes some interesting arguments about faith with talking about different gods and everything with the fact that the Lord Ruler was, I think Yeoman's the one of them that says like, yeah, I've heard about these other religions that, you know, proclaiming faith in a non-existing deity, like a non-present deity, which I never understood. Why worship this thing you've never seen when quite literally, like, we got a god right here that, like, he lives down the road. It's God. He's lived for over 1,000 years. He's changed the land. Like, functionally speaking, God, he literally moved the planet into a different orbit and caused the ash clouds. So, also immortal and all powerful. Sounds like God to me. And I look at that and I find it funny of, other than the fact that Lord Ruler died, wouldn't that make the most sense to Sazed? I would think the Lord Ruler as a faith, like worshiping the Lord Ruler, follows all the logical steps. Like, not many holes in that one. He's all powerful. He created everything that you see. That's the tenets.
Well, all powerful and also all kind? What are the tenets of? All powerful, omnipotence.
The argument against God is God cannot be all good.
That's it. All good,
all powerful, and all knowing.
Yes. Yeah, so
he has to be two.
Our Lord Ruler here is all powerful, but not all good. Or all knowing. Yeah.
He has
the power.
But thing is, he never says he's all knowing or all good. Mm-hmm. He's just all powerful. Mm-hmm. He's kind of pretty open about it. I'm just like, yeah, I'm your God. I control everything. all right, follow what I say because I'm all powerful. That's pretty honest for a god.
You'd probably respect that.
I respect that. The honesty of just, I'm in charge. I'm not saying I'm necessarily good at this, but I'm in charge.
The finale of this, where it all comes together, and Vin and Ellen die in the end.
Yeah.
Wait. So the build up to that of Ellen gets to the ATM stash, which is found through Sazed going back to the Chondra, because from Tensoon escaping, I'm kind of starting back going forward. I should start with Tensoon escapes, runs into Sazed, and tells Sazed to go to back to the Chondra lands. And through that, he finds out his journey through purpose, and as he's seeking faith and seeks the first ever Terrace people, the first generation, which we're now introduced to this book, seeks that, but while he's doing so, finds out that the Atium is there all along. Ultimately, Ellen goes there, finds the Atium stash, and Atium is a part of Ruin himself. Atium is a god-esque. It's his body.
And thing is, Ellen doesn't know that. I'm pretty sure he doesn't know that.
He does it by the end, yes?
Oh, by the very end, this is the body. But ultimately, isn't a lot of it he burns the Atium away just because, like, you want this. I'm just going to burn it all away.
And the whole plan, the mind-blowing thing for me was the Lord Ruler's play into all of this, so setting up the five stashes, but then the way he disguised the Atium and sent it throughout and kept it even secret from his Inquisitors, but would have this whole trade where he hid them inside of other metals, because the metals, as we built up this whole time, blinded Ruin. Mm-hmm. Ruin cannot, it's like a beacon to him. He can't see. So he would hide them and store them right next to Luthadel the whole entire time.
Well, even better is where the ATM was mined, the Pits of Hath-Sin.
Right there.
He just.
It's just go right there. There. Yeah, that's it.
Moved like 100 feet. Just. Yep. That way.
Yes. It kind of, similar to Well of Ascension, was just right there. Yeah. So
hiding in plain sight.
Hiding in plain sight. And so the Lord Rulers play into all of this. Vin and the reveal of how the Copper Cloud works, and preservation's plan the whole time to create, you must destroy to create as well. And the harmony and balance that is created, where Vin ultimately sacrifices herself to also kill Ruin. And through that, see their dead bodies and Sazed. Could you help explain this to how Sazed then gets that power?
So in the Cosmere, when the conscious entity of a shard bearer, which the
shards are
a fragment of the ultimate deity that basically rules the Cosmere. It's the ultimate power of different planets and different areas. And
this one is Scadrial.
Scadrial, yeah. Yeah. So
this planet,
This planet has two shards of, and used to be apparently one shard, but has been split. We don't know how, we don't know why, but into both Ruin and Preservation. Mm-hmm. Both of these shards are forms of power that have their own type of will, that when a mortal being takes on the power and actually becomes its, not its master, but kind of merges with the power. Now the power is a merge of the shard's general purpose and also the wielder or the user's will, generally. So the whole thing is when a shard bearer or holder dies, basically the power is trying to find another host, and it normally chooses the person who's closest by wherever the person dies, wherever the shard bearer dies. Now, I don't know, like, where exactly, why do they die and where they are. Who knows? We'll see. A lot of that's just the storytelling, but Sazed is the closest person there.
And he ends up being Ruin and Preservation. He ends up having the power to reshape the world. He is the hero of ages in the end. And he has to be the character to solve this all, his whole faith journey. He was the one that stored through all of his entire life, each and every faith throughout the world. And this, the satisfying end for me, is obviously Sazed's character arc and how it's meaningful to him, but just the sweetness of the end after Vin and Ellen, air quotes, die, because there's a mention toward the end where
that's what Ellen, I wanted to talk to you about.
That's the portion, where Ellen and Vin, Sazed apparently spoke to them and they're doing okay. He mentions that in the end.
He also says that, I also made you Mistborn because that's what Kelsier wanted for you.
Yeah, so...
Was Seiza telling the truth? Or was he playing a role of God of, like, that's what they need?
That makes me like the ending even more. Wow. I don't know.
When he's going, like, the consequence of faith matters more than the actual
truth. I heard that Secret Histories answers this, and we haven't read that yet.
No. See, so I've heard answers to it, but I don't know if it's flashbacks of Kels.
I don't know, but Secret Histories, I'm told to read that next.
Not next.
The patrons say that. Say read that next, yeah.
No.
They're hounding me to.
No.
They told me to.
They're wrong.
What to read next?
You have to read, I believe, Bands of Mourning first before you can read it, because it spoils some Era 2 stuff.
They said some of that, but they said no. They still said Secret History.
That's because they don't like Era 2, and they're like, just skip it. I don't think you should skip it.
Oh,
you don't want to spoil yourself.
Okay.
You're eventually going to read it. Okay, not eventually. You should read it now with me.
Okay.
I just read Wax and Wayne.
Okay.
We should review it together.
Okay. I'll read it.
Now I'm pushing Lonesome Dove and Howling Dark.
I'll read it right now.
Screw you. Read more, damn it. You can... If I can read, you could do it, too.
You're talking about your 12,000 books a month? That's crazy.
Yeah. Good. Come on, man.
I think it's biting you now because things are getting stressful now.
They are.
Yeah,
it's honest. I'm juggling a lot. It's not healthy. I don't have a free. I spent like an hour playing a little bit of my Zelda game, and I felt bad. I was like,
I have so much to do.
So much reading to do. I can't afford to play my Zelda game.
So in the end, they air quotes die. Well, don't know, but the important thing is, it's such a satisfying end to see all the religions and. How it's cool that not just the religions believed in something, that they had this... it's not that he took their deity or took something that was an untruth or a myth. It wasn't a mythos. It was they had something that was actually true about the world. Their star alignments, their story had truth to it that made sure the future could be recreated like the beauty it once was, which there's such a cool... I get message to that, but there's such a cool, satisfying end to that of just a perfect bow tie. And we see actually Scott asked this question of is Skadrial kind of not a metaphor, but is it supposed to be Earth in a way with all the flowers and greenery? Was it supposed to be Earth in a sense, which others were saying, no, it's not supposed to be exactly Earth. It's its own world, but
it's supposed to be Earth-like.
Yeah. We could imagine the flowers and the greenery in an Earth-like planet like that. But to me, just perfect ending. Done.
Yeah.
Tied to knot. I was so satisfied. Gives me such faith for how Stormlight will end. And
also, I liked that Spook became a Mistborn at the end. It feels nice to, like, the future of Skadrial or after this, the rest of the crew, they have Spook to continue on, to help things along. Like, he proved himself... I liked sending him off as the next hero where we don't need another story with Spook, but I like knowing Spook is there to save the day.
Yeah, I was not saying boo to that.
Haha. I get it.
Yeah.
Spook, boo.
Yeah.
Woo.
I'm going to stop with puns. Okay, world building.
I like your puns.
World building, what'd you give it out of 5 stars?
This is the big one, 4.75.
Too low. 5 stars.
Yeah.
5 stars. World floored me. Yeah, floored me.
We've talked a little bit about this throughout it, but just the nature. This is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when this book came out, this definitely delved further into the nature of the Cosmere and how the Cosmere really functions.
Like it came out 2008, so yeah.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about the order of the books released. And
it was Elantris.
Elantris,
then
Mistborn.
Mistborn 1, 2, 3, I think.
No, I thought he had Stormlight in 1 in there.
No, Way of Kings was 2010.
Got it. So, yeah, this is the start of how does, like, okay, there's a wider universe here.
Mm-hmm.
How does the Cosmere really function? I think reading this, you go into Stormlight with a lot more understanding of the nature of how these different powers and mysticism work.
Yeah.
I think it's very important and also very fun.
Even on its own was just such a fantastic world. Hinted at earlier of how the history, the cultural effects of the Lord Ruler and Kelsier and having different fervent faiths of what happens in martyrdom was really cool to see in the impact of those cities. And I think what he does really well with his world, at least in Mistborn, what he highlights here is both the magic systems and magic systems. He's got a great setting to it, the mists naturally, but so magic systems and also the impact of history and religion. And I guess magic systems being the biggest one, want to start there with how cool the structure is, where book one starts us with a focus on allomancy and we get some Furukami. Book two, kind of some more Furukami stuff. Sorry, I'm saying these wrong. And then book three, Hemallergy.
Is it Furukami?
Furukami, I think. Furukami, I think. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So,
because I know I got it wrong when I said it's ferrochemistry is wrong.
Oh, yeah.
That's real wrong.
It's Furukami, I believe.
Furukami.
Allomancy is definitely right, though. We got Allomancy down. Hemallergy, I believe. But this book's focused on Hemallergy, and that addition to the magic system, already kind of adding on to, we have our base with Furukami and Allomancy. Mm-hmm. Not often in a book series, in a trilogy, do you get three different magic systems. Usually you get one and you stick with that, and it's like, oh, I got a magic system about one gender can't do magic. Oh, look how creative I am.
I can do magic, but that's fine.
Shows you how big of a fan I am.
Yeah.
what is it that what's the system? I thought only Aes Sedai could. Oh, well, they can, but they're not allowed.
Safely.
Yeah, they're
kind of
unruly.
Also do it, but it's then not safe. They turn into walking nukes.
Yes. Yeah. Kind of cool. So within this trilogy, you have three different magic systems. Then this third one that happens, the satisfying part about it is how it's ingrained in the three big types of creatures, I guess you could say, we see here, where it's the Chondra, we have the Kolos, Chondra, Kolos, and the
Allomancers.
The Inquisitors, the Obligators.
Of Hermal.
The Marshes.
Got it. The creatures of Hemallergy.
Yes. And so just to spitball stuff off, because there's so much to this, like whatever you want to focus on. We could go Chondras and how Lord Ruler created them, the deal he had with them, the Kolos and the discovery that they're just taken from other people and stuck with the spikes, how Ruin actually has control of them in the end, how many spikes you get, you can actually become basically the Lord Ruler, where Marsh was able to have Lord Ruler powers at the end as well. Where do you want to go with that? Anything that stuck out to you that was cool?
There's just so many things that make sense, especially in hindsight, of the level of control Ruin has. So if the power of Hemallergy being Ruin's power, of Allomancy is of preservation, and Furukami being not neutral. Really either.
It's seemed the balance.
I believe like that was the power before. Before Ruin and Preservation kind of split and made their own things, like Furukami was there before Allomancy and before Hemallergy. And then we find out, why is Hemallergy the power of Ruin? Because it never creates. Every time that it is used, you're reducing the power. Like you're taking from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's not taken in equal measure. Like you take a Misting's power and you put it into someone else. And that power becomes slightly less. And so ultimately, as Ruin is creating more powerful tools, he's just reducing power.
Destroying,
ultimately, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. And how much, ultimately, the things that he control the most are the things that caused and required the most destruction. You know, the Inquisitors being, you know, Marsh, I think, had like, what, over 20 spikes in his body? It's like, it's a lot of dead people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of impaled people.
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't know. It just makes sense. Mm-hmm. The Chondra only having two tiny spikes, and so their influence can be controlled, but not completely. And it makes sense how they're able to have some type of will.
Didn't,
over
they had four types of creations too, wasn't it? Like, so they had four different types.
Well, it was... It's not really a type. They're all Chondra or the Chondra, but the spikes give them a certain blessing.
Yeah. What were those four types of blessings?
It's based on the metal that they get. I forget. There's one of...
Not Polis, was it?
foresight or something. There's one that's it's a mental one where they're able to mental clarity. Mm. There's another one of endurance.
Certain type of powers.
Connected to allomancy, basically. Yeah. Of it's a constant power up, but not very strong, ultimately on its own. Anyway, it just makes sense and it's so much fun.
It does.
That's the long and short. That's the short of it, really. Mm-hmm. It's fun.
It is. And the ash and mists and how, I guess, how the entire world works with the Lord Ruler shifting the world. And now we see Sazed shift it back to itself. I love the whole concept as well of this post-apocalyptic, the Lord Ruler already won. Turns out in the history, he wasn't. We already got tidbits of this, but him being Rashik and killing the person who was going to get the power and use it for Ruin's will, Lord Ruler actually saved the day in a way, and then was preparing for the return, was preparing for humanity to come to its next apocalyptic and wanted to go to the Wall of Ascension. Vin releases the Wall of Ascension, thinking that she's doing the right thing. Ultimately, in this book, we see the Lord Ruler plan and how it worked with the Atium, how the caches worked, and the inscriptions and Ruin's ability to also affect the inscriptions and writing and how he can't see metal, which explains the whole how the ATM stash was hidden, but also get some cool world stuff with just Ellen talking with Preservation, not understanding Preservation, him logicking through like Vin does or others, and him kind
of great
having
moment
that
of
scene.
Him writing on the dirt and Ruin changing it to die, I'm gonna kill you.
Yes.
And it's just like Ellen pretty quickly going, you didn't write that, did you?
No.
Mistress like, no.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. He's a silly goose.
He's a silly Billy.
He's all, So it gets to so many just cool moments. And then the impact of martyrdom with Kelsier, not to reiterate, but the just all of it does make sense. That's what it comes down to, is there's, it's just so well thought out.
Also, to answer a normal problem I have with world building, or not even a problem, but just something I like to see.
Yeah.
Is I love to see cultures and how cultures change over time and history.
Yep.
Specifically, this Chris Sanderson did a great job cutting me off at the pass of there's a specific reason why for 1,000 years culture and history has been very stagnant. It's basically been the same for over 1,000 years because the Lord Ruler deliberately made it that way. He changed the world. He has ultimate control. He, you know, through central planning, he made the society the way he wanted, and then he resisted any sort of change that someone would try to do.
Yeah.
Against his perfect utopia.
Yep.
So that's why cultures have not changed in over 1,000 years, and technology is basically
stagnant.
Yeah. Yeah. So made sense why, but you still get a little tidbits. You get with Sazed of all the researching religions of each one of them valued something before the Lord. They worship something grand that happened before the Lord Ruler, and they all carry this piece of knowledge through their history. And because not every people survived after the ash came.
Mm.
Like, not everyone died during that. So like, all across the world, the people's knowledge carried forward past the apocalypse to be able to save the day in the end. Perfect.
Very cool. Very cool.
Anything else for world building?
No, just when I look back to this trilogy, I think as a whole as well, I thought just the magic systems with allomancy would be the cool part because that's what I knew about it, but ended up actually being invested in everything. Felt completely real to me as I was reading it. I was going, wow. So awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's hard
stuff.
To even give any kind of criticism on it. It's just.
He does exactly what he wants. It tries and attempts to do here. Mm-hmm. So what do you have for pros out of 5 stars?
Pros, 3.75.
3.5 for me. Good. Good pros.
I think it's real good.
Good.
Sanderson's good at this. He knows how to write. Generally.
I saw an improvement from book one to book three.
Mm.
Almost, I wouldn't say drastic, but definitely an improvement in dialogue, at the very least.
Sure. I didn't reread book one, so it's hard for me to judge.
That's fair. Yeah.
Because I gave it a gut reaction before of a 3.75 on book one.
Okay.
Probably on a reread, I don't doubt that you're right, that there's an improvement.
Yeah, it does. It feels like he definitely improved, and I think in this book, to give a couple things, my only other note would be I have an example portion in here to read off. Unless do you have a comment on the pros? Because you just reread this as well. Do you have a comment on?
I'll give you a good example of what's better is all the dialogue from Zane and Vin.
Is not there.
Is not here. That dialogue was not realistic. It was kind of cringe.
Good enough. Yeah, I agree.
So that's not here. It's great. That makes it so much better.
I've heard as well, I think with Mistborn, I mean, this is a bit of an obvious point, but you really see Sanderson start to become one of his own here. You see the hints of just what makes a Sanderson book. Sander Lanch, of course, is here. Even though there was there in the previous two, I think you really felt it in this book.
His focus on the world building, the magic system being an integral part of the history and how things are made. He's the fantasy version of, like, you know, how stuff's made.
Yeah.
That's what he enjoys. And does that require a little bit of telling, not showing with the epigraphs? Sure, it does, but he does it in such a fun way that no one minds, I think.
I agree. I have a section here that kind of expresses a lot of what Sanderson does for his themes and his characters. He'll have this internal debate, internal dialogue. I'm using an example from Sazed.
Okay.
Because this just kind of shows what does Sanderson do when he has an inner monologue in character contemplating something around him. I feel like that he does that a ton in this book. It's a lot of it. So this is Sazed struggling with his faith. Certain point. So
okay.
He couldn't believe. If he believed, it meant that God or the universe or whatever it was that watched over man had failed. Better to believe that there was nothing at all. Then all the world's inadequacies were simple mere chance, not caused by a God who had failed them. Sazed glanced at his open tome, noticing a little slip of paper sticking out between its pages. He pulled it free, surprised to find the picture of a flower that Vin had given him, the one that Kelsier's wife had carried. The one she'd used to give herself hope, to remind her of a world that had existed before the coming of the Lord Ruler. He glanced upward. The ceiling was of wood, but red sunlight, refracted by the window, sprayed across it. "Why?" he whispered. "Why leave me like this? I studied everything about you. I learned the religions of 500 different peoples and sects. I taught about you when other men had given up 1,000 years before. Why leave me without hope when others can have faith? Why leave me to wonder? Shouldn't I be more certain than any other? Shouldn't my knowledge have protected me?" And yet, his faith had made him even more susceptible. "That's what trust is," Sazed thought. "It's about giving someone else power over you, power to hurt you." That's why he'd given up his metal mines. That's why he had decided to sort through the religions one at a time, trying to find one that had no faults, nothing to fail him. It just made sense. Better to not believe, rather than be proven wrong. Sazed looked back down. Why did he think to talk to the heavens? There was nothing there. There never had been. Outside, in the hallway, he could hear voices. "My dear doggy," Bree said. "Sure you'll stay for another day." "No," said Tensoon, the Chandra, speaking in his growling voice. "I must find Vin as soon as possible." "Even the Chandra," Sazed thought, "even an inhuman creature has more faith than I." And yet, how could they understand? Sazed closed his eyes tight, feeling a pair of tears squeeze from the corners. How could anyone understand the pain of faith betrayed? He had believed, and yet, when he had needed hope the most, he had only found emptiness. He picked up the book, then snapped close his portfolio, locking the inadequate summaries inside. He turned toward the hearth. Better to simply burn it all. Belief. He remembered a voice from the past, his own voice, speaking to Vin on that terrible day after Kelsier's death. "Belief isn't simply a thing for fair times and bright days, I think. What is belief? What is faith? If you don't continue in it after failure." How innocent he had been. "Better to trust and be betrayed," Kelsier seemed to whisper. It had been one of the survivors' mottos, "better to love and be hurt." Sazed gripped the tome. It was such a meaningless thing. Its text could be changed by ruin at any time. "And do I believe in that?" Sazed thought with frustration. "Do I have faith in ruin, but not in something better?" To give that long section there of that's one of many of Sanderson's kind of style throughout this book. I think it's emblematic a bit of just he likes to have the character questioning back and forth, why this, look back to that, contemplate themselves, make sure it's always very clear to the reader here of, hey, look, this is what the character's struggle is. This is what their journey's all about. Mm-hmm. And part of that is why at the end where you feel that catharsis is going, man, look how long he was in the mud here. He's definitely a fan of Wheel of Time where he lets you sit and simmer, but it's way more exciting in this. So, but he definitely lets you sit and simmer, and that kind of back and forth, does that make you rethink about the message at all. That was kind of what we were going over in the message, I think, pretty one for one.
Yeah, basically. It's a great example of Sanderson being pretty simplistic and clear, not anything confusing, but letting you get, you just get to sit with his Sazed's emotional struggle and seeing him at his lowest.
Yes.
It's enjoyable to see that back and forth.
It is. And he does a good job at doing callbacks and all that, but again, not, that's kind of the Sanderson prose people talk about, I think. Mm-hmm. And his, at least in this book, didn't see any crazy action scenes. And there were action scenes, but
yeah,
in comparison.
In comparison to
Abercrombie.
Name a duel, or Abercrombie.
Yeah.
I was going to compare it to Sanderson himself of, is anything in here
better than Stormlight? No.
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 But that's the fight scenes of Stormlight. Then.
Yeah.
Magnum opus. Yeah. Great stuff.
Yeah. Anything to sign us off with, Rich? This was the Hero of Ages review. Book good overall.
Book good. Good book. Fantastic. Spectacular. All those things. Read it.
We're finished with the Mistborn trilogy.
I'm continuing on with Era 2. Let us know if you want us to continue on reviewing it.
Yes.
Or do people just want a... That would actually be the question. Hmm. Do people want a book-by-book review of Era 2, or do you want just a Mistborn Era 2 review where we just read all four books and then give our review of all four?
Let us know.
Because I've heard the popularity of them not as much, so maybe people just want one big fat review.
I feel like we should give them the credit they're due.
Good.
To do that. But,
are
they that bad?
A lot of people think they're Sanderson's worst.
Are you one of those people out there? Let us know.
Yeah. I liked Wax and Wayne. It was fun.
Better than Mistborn for Era 1? Or
I think better than Book 2 of Era 1.
Fair enough. But not... Oh, yeah. What was your order? Would you say mine was 3, 1, 2?
Yeah, same here.
Okay.
Yeah, completely.
Okay.
All right.
Let us know also your order of them. 3, 1, 2 for us. All right. Next episode, we'll see you all. We kept this to hour 40. Not bad. Not a bad book review.
Condensed.
This is our condensed version. Wait till you see the long takes. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.